April 3rd. Quorum is present. The Minnesota Senate Education Committee will now come to order. We have four bills before us today. Welcome everybody out in the audience. The first one is Senator Mann's Senate File 1318. And if there's any paraprofessionals for the schools in the audience, it's an appreciation day, so there'll be donuts and cupcakes and treats maybe somewhere. Sorry for that frivolity. Senator Mann, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. In front of you is 1318, otherwise known as the Education Support Professionals Bill of Rights, or as Senator Swadzinski rightfully calls it, the Critical Education Professionals Bill. In the last several years, Minnesota students have gone through a lot, and there are many things that we as a legislating body can do to help them recover. One of those things is to stabilize the workforce within our schools and to ensure that the relationships that children are building within those walls are preserved. And of course, we stabilize the workforce within our schools so that our kids can have the best possible education experience. The goal of 1318 is to improve the learning environment in Minnesota schools by reducing staff turnover and encouraging non-licensed educators to build their skills and experience to even better serve our children. When we do this successfully, we also build a teacher pipeline to get more qualified teachers into our schools. ESPs are the bus drivers, the nutrition workers, the paraprofessionals, the janitorial staff, the clerical staff. They are the tutors, the translators, and the hall monitors. They are the ones who care for our children with special needs. They are currently the lowest paid workers in a school. You can walk down the street to a McDonald's and get paid more than you do working in our schools, transporting, feeding, and helping educate our children. ESPs typically need to work a second or third job to make ends meet, and I will also note that they are also the most racially diverse group of people within a school. So some of the highlights of 1318, it raises the wage for ESPs and contracted school workers to $25 an hour through a formula based on the number of ESPs that a district employs. It provides 16 hours of paid training to all support personnel who interact directly with our children. It requires districts to pay ESPs for lost wages for unforeseen school closures. Schools are already paid for these days. And finally, it addresses the fairly shocking situation around the cost of health care insurance for hourly workers in schools. We have heard stories of people having to essentially give back their paycheck because their health insurance costs more than what they make. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have an A5 amendment, and I can briefly walk through that. If somebody could introduce it.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
So the author introduces the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Move. Okay. The first testifier is Michelle Denard.
Good morning, Madam Chair, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Michelle Denard, and I am an education support professional in the Osseo Public Schools, bringing nearly two decades of experience to my role. I am here today to emphasize the critical importance of supporting ESPs and ensuring the stability to our employment. I want to commend the legislature for its decision to guarantee pay for hourly school workers on e-learning days. Previously, districts often exploit these days to reduce our hours, creating financial uncertainty of ESPs by requiring the districts pay us for these instructional days. The legislator has taken a significant step towards providing much needed financial security for ESP across the state. However, I urge the committee to consider the broader impact of unexpected cuts to our schedules, such as early release and late start days. These disruptions create hardships for ESPs, forcing some of us to struggle to pay bills and feed our families. In some cases, we even find ourselves owing the district money due to insufficient funds to cover health insurance costs when our check come up short. Every dollar counts for ESPs. And an additional $40 or $50 can mean the difference between financial stability and crisis, particularly in times of economic hardship. It's imperative to understand that ESPs are the backbone of our schools, and we must do everything in our power to retain these dedicated professionals. In my district alone, there are currently 57 open positions for education support personnel. We cannot afford to lose these essential workers who are the glue holding our schools together, guaranteeing our hours at the beginning of each pay period. It's not just a matter of fairness, it's a necessity for our livelihoods. Thank you for your time and consideration. I implore you to support legislation that ensures to continue support and stability of ESPs across our state.
Thank you. Next up, we have Melissa Grew and Denise Dietrich and Tina Burkholder. Or I guess, that might not be the right order, but come on up at your leisure. Make sure you sign in the book and introduce yourself for the record and begin when you're ready.
My name is Melissa Gruy. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Melissa Gruy. I'm a paraeducator and SEIU 284 member from Mounds View. I want to start by thanking you for your work on pay training for paraeducators. In our current times, schools are experiencing staff shortages, which means paraeducators are often assigned to new rooms and different students without notice. Now more than ever before, we are required to be ready for anything and yet continue to receive little training. Thank you for the 8 hours of paid training you passed last year, and thank you for the requirements that districts consult with paras like me as they design the training. We definitely could use more time, but knowing that the time we have will be well spent learning about topics that are relevant and important for our day-to-day workload is appreciated. After 20 years of working in education, can you believe I'm not a millionaire? I'm here today because I truly love the work that I do. Unfortunately, it has also come with a huge financial sacrifice for my family. Sadly, the job I love doesn't pay enough to sufficiently support my family. In addition to my work at Mounds View, I work at Target 2 to 3 nights a week. I haven't always had to work two jobs. However, my one paycheck is not enough anymore. My district paycheck just could not stretch any further. My district tends to shy away from late start and early release days, but this does happen. Once a building in my district had raccoons in the attic. Another time, my small program had 3 teachers out with the flu and closed due to illness. We do sometimes have to close buildings for partial days. It's critical that workers like me get paid for these days. When my pay is less than normal, I try to cut out luxury items such as paper towels or snacks like sliced cheese sticks. These items are not necessarily a luxury, but my kids notice when they're not there. Working in education, I believe in its importance. Yet as an educator, I will struggle to financially support my own child as they go off to college. As a mom, I feel bad that our family's financial situation dictated what colleges he applied for. I am not sure how my family will handle the financial responsibility of having a college student. My family has already struggled to adjust to the economy. Our money can't stretch further. When districts are paid, workers should be paid. Thank you for your work on this.
Thank you. Next up, Ms. Dietrich. And then our last testifier is remote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I am here testifying on behalf of the 331 public school boards and superintendents, secondary and elementary school principals, and the Association of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. So we really appreciate the opportunity to share some of our observations and concerns with Senate File 1381. So I'd like to start with some context. State law requires that school boards and exclusive representatives meet and negotiate in good faith to collectively bargain the terms and conditions of employment. Terms and conditions of employment means the hours of employment, compensation, premiums for group health insurance, and the employer's personnel policies affecting the workplace conditions. Today, each of the provisions addressed in this bill can be collectively bargained and agreed upon: training, compensation, and benefits. Establishing a new baseline for benefits and pay at the state level significantly impacts the balance at the bargaining table. It usurps the role of the school board. It fails to take into consideration that the local school district budget and the budgeting process and the strategic goals and initiatives that have already been determined and in process through the work of the school board, staff, and the community. This bill would eliminate collective bargaining for health care premiums and out-of-pocket expenses, since it would be now established in state law. Currently, we have some school districts that are in the middle of the collective bargaining process, and adoption of this bill would not only significantly impact those districts that have not reached an agreement, but those school districts that have already bargained in good faith to reach an agreement on salaries and benefits. So in addition, this bill's impact will be different on each school district. And as written, the effective dates are a very big concern for school boards. So moreover, these provisions will significantly increase school district costs without any certainty in funding. For example, when this bill was previously heard, two school districts shared the impact of the $25 per hour minimum wage of support personnel. One larger district of over 13,000 students estimated a cost of $3.4 million. $1.7 million of that would need to come from the general fund. The impact, it could result in reducing 17 counselors or social workers. A smaller district reported that it would need to reduce their budget by $1 million. The impact, fewer teachers, fewer support staff. While offering levy authority may seem like an effective way to fund these costs, a levy increase for this purpose increases the very real prospect of a no vote when it comes to passing an operating referendum. This only makes the school district budgeting process even more uncertain and unstable when there are already 49 metro districts reporting funding shortfalls of $317 million in the next school year. And it needs to be said that this a levy is a property tax increase. And we all know that there is an inherent inequity across school districts when funding comes from the local property taxes. The leadership role and responsibility of our boards are important to a strong public school system. Board members work and live in their communities, and they step forward to ensure that public schools remain strong while focused on the student success. Decisions, whether financial or policy related, are best made by those who are closest and feel closest to the issues and feel the impact. These important decisions are best made at the local level through balanced, fair, and an honest bargaining process. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you so much, Ms. Dietrich. Next, we have remote Tina Burkholder, Director of Business Services.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tina Burkholder, and I'm the Director of Business Services at Monticello Public Schools and the Legislative Committee Chair of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. As a school business official who is responsible for the budget and costing of labor contracts, I just have a few concerns to comment on Senate File 1318. To raise the minimum starting wage to $25 an hour will have cost impacts to school districts. It won't only raise the minimum starting wage, but it'll also raise the tiered steps that follow and would have to be balanced across all contracts in the school district, including certified staff, to ensure equitable pay and job duties. As an example, I'm not proud to say that our starting teacher hourly rate for the 22-23 school year was $27.96. So all those steps and lanes would have to be adjusted up. With our Magic Adventure childcare program, the starting wage that would affect our families with higher childcare rates. It looks like there's aid appropriated to help fund the difference, but this should also take into account the extra 17% in benefits that occur with higher wages, such as PERA, FICA, workers' compensation insurance, and the new paid family leave tax starting in 2026. For the health insurance benefits, the language in the bill specifies offering benefits if working 4 hours per day without mentioning the hours per week. If an employee works more than only one day a week, but more than 4 hours, would they qualify? The language should be modified to include either a minimum hours a week or an annual hours. Currently, most, if not all, school district contracts follow federal law where employees are benefit eligible if they work at least 30 hours a week. School districts also have several different plan offerings with varying cost. Is the required contribution based on the lowest cost plan, or would there be different contributions for each plan that's offered? This will create additional costs and be harder for business offices and HR teams to administer simultaneously. Finance people aren't against giving higher wages to people, but we just know it all comes at a cost and has to fit within the state and school's budget. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for zooming in with your testimony. Are there any other folks out there that want to testify? No? All right, members, any questions or comments? Senator Farnsworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. So the first question is, I'm wondering, Senator, you increased the training from 8 to 16 hours. I'm just wondering, is there some study or is there specific courses that would fit into that 16 hours, or would that be left to the flexibility of the local school district to determine what classes would be provided in that 16 hours?
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair. So the goal was to always have 2 to 3 days of training. So we got 8 last year, so that's why we increased it this year. And then on lines 5.13 to 5.16, this section of statute relates to instructional programs for paras and how they obtain credentialing and the details of training that they should have, and offers examples of these trainings, so that can be taken out of statute.
Follow up, Senator?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. I can look at the citation for that. So I see at the end, I think even and on the amendment, there's a blank appropriation. Do we have any idea of what something like this would cost, an estimate at all?
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair, not yet.
Senator Farnsworth.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just have kind of a final comment. I'm still a special ed teacher, and I started out as an EBD teacher, so I had the kids that kicked and bit, and so I often worked with PSAs, and so I'm sympathetic to especially to the salary part, because they have, I think, the worst jobs in most school districts. But I'm also a proud union member, and I pay union dues to my union to negotiate wages and benefits, and so I struggle with having the state act as the collective bargaining unit. This is something that should be negotiated between workers and their employer, especially if we don't know what it's going to cost the state. Again, this is an idea that I'm generally supportive of, but it's something that should be done through the collective bargaining process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farnsworth. Anybody else? Senator Rarick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask the question as well around what the anticipated costs are. I guess if that's unknown, a follow-up to that would be, depending on what we would appropriate from this committee, is it mostly just going to be expected of each individual school district to cover the costs of this bill?
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair, no. So the bill has multiple lines of appropriations, and none of this is expected to be covered by the school.
Senator Rick, follow-up.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. So is it your intention that if the funding is not available through this committee, that you're not going to push the bill itself to push those costs onto the school districts?
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair. Senator, yeah, there's a couple pieces that are policy, and I would love to see those go through, but it is my intention that there is no money. We are not going to put this on the schools to cover.
Thank you, Senator Mann. Anything else? Anyone else? Senator Gustafson, and then Senator Swadzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Mann, for this bill. I know we talked about this last year, and I liked it then. I like it now. I know it's expensive. I know everyone was worried about the costs. I like that you have multiple lanes for appropriation. But I think the bottom line is that we know that the people who work in our schools, whether they're teachers or paras or support staff, and by the way, I want to say thank you to Ms. Gruey. My kids go to the school that you work at, and I just appreciate everything you do. Thank you so much for being here today. None of them are paid enough. They're certainly not paid enough for the work that they do, and every time that they come forward and ask for more money, we all want to do it, and we just always find ways to say we can't afford it. And I think that we need to keep asking. We need to find ways to pay for it. I always go back to this. In my Senate district, if you are a starting police officer right out of the academy, $90,000 in Lino Lakes. If you want to start at the corrections facility, it's $57,000 starting wage right out of college. If you, or you know, community college or training. If you want to become, I think it is, the title is like an assistant building permit specialist or something for the city of Lino Lakes, it's like $63,000, and that's right out of school. If you want to become a teacher at Centennial High School, like me, right out of school, I made $36,000 a year, and then went on to get my master's, and I tapped out at $40,000 a year. So we just have it's an unequal system of professionals who work in our schools, take care of our kids, are there for them most of hours of the day, and we just still have not figured out a way to pay them what they deserve. So I thank you for this. I'm sad there's no room on the bill, but I'm glad that you keep bringing it forward, and I hope we can figure out a way to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gustafson. Senator Swadzinski.
I want to thank you as well. I don't know what building in Moundsview you work in, but my first teaching job, I was 25 years old, and there was a young woman who was in a gymnastics accident, and it was the first time I ever realized how hard, and I was, I had no idea that these people existed behind the scenes, because as a kid growing up, if they were in the room or if they even existed, you didn't pay attention to them because you're watching the teacher and whatnot and monkeying around with your classmates. But when you become the teacher and you realize the important role that this, at first I thought it was a parent of the child, but then to find out, no, this is a paid employee who was working harder than I was at the time because that young woman was paralyzed from the neck down. And like I said, in a gymnastics accident. And I just thought, and now years later, when I hear this bill, and thank you for acknowledging the change of the word support to critical staff, which is something I've been talking about for years now, and I start realizing as teachers, we rest on the shoulders of giants, and those giants are the people that are behind the scenes and who are the unsung heroes of our schools. And I don't know what's going to come of your bill. I don't know where the money's going to come from. I don't know if it should be a negotiated thing in local local control versus us finding the money at the state level. But I do, I'm eternally grateful to you for bringing the attention to the forefront of the hard work, because most parents, most kids, all they ever see is the world through the teacher's eyes. And we just don't know that all the work that goes on behind the scenes, whether it's cooks or bus drivers or the people that are wheeling a young woman who is paralyzed from the neck down into the classroom so that her education can continue in the best way possible. So I just can't thank you enough for drawing attention to this. And I've been sitting here listening to the debate today, and what a thought I had in my head was, if this was a male-dominated profession, how different this conversation may be today. And anyways, but that's for a philosophical debate at a further hearing. But thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Senator Swadzinski. Senator Umaverbaden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Mann. I just wanted to say that Michelle Denard's testimony really stuck with me, and our critical staff, like potentially owing the districts just to cover the cost of health insurance, that just makes me sick. And I know you're committed to finding this funding and making sure that our school districts have the resources to provide this $25 an hour minimum wage. I do think our role as a state is to set that sort of baseline. And I mean, that is, I think, the bare minimum. And I hope that we're able to figure that out and provide this funding. But the staff do amazing work. Really want to thank all of you that are here and that testified online. You just deserve better, and I really hope we're able to do that this year. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Umaverbaden. Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the consultation piece, there's already a requirement for both sides to meet and negotiate in good faith and collective bargaining. So what exactly in lines 1.12 and 1.13 does this consultation requirement, what are you hoping to achieve with that?
Madam Chair.
Senator Mann.
Senator, so what's happening is that you have people coming in to design a training, but paras, so we're training paras, but there are no paras consulted when they design this training. So in the last year, they've been having conversations with paras all over the state who say that the training that they are receiving is not actually relevant to their work. And so we're just saying, whoever you're training, have that representation in the training design so that the training you get is relevant to the work that you're doing.
Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. What is there anything in current law right now that would prohibit the union representation from bringing up these training things in negotiations?
Madam Senator Chair. Mann.
Not that I'm aware of, but it just isn't happening.
Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what does consulting actually mean? What if a school district just says, thank you for your input, and they do what they want to do anyway?
Senator Mann.
Madam Chair, that may happen.
Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just get concerned here when the legislature starts encroaching on some of these collective bargaining agreement issues and negotiations and places emphasis and in terms of how those negotiations should look. I think having a good faith negotiating standard is the way to go. And every time you add something like this, there's gonna be something else that a union is gonna say, well, we're not being listened to on that, and then we're gonna be adding those requirements as well. And pretty soon we're gonna have a legislatively dictated collective bargaining agreement negotiation where, you know, it's just a long list of checks that, you know, they're supposed to do. Ultimately, I don't know if this is going to change anything. But the other concern I have, obviously, is, you know, this, it's not like school districts right now when they're negotiating these collective bargaining agreements with these particular employee groups, that nobody wants to pay them. I don't think there's any school board or administrators out there purposely trying to depress these wages. But again, there's a finite dollars, and each district might have different needs in terms of what is most pressing in their district in terms of where they want to place that money. And so to me, the solution to that is to allow the school district's flexibility to use the resources that the state is providing, reduce the mandates, and have those school districts place those resources in the areas that best fit the needs of those local districts. And in a lot of cases, that probably would be in this category. I know when I was on the school board, that was a point of emphasis, and but it may not be the same for all school districts. So that's my comment. Thanks.
Senator Mayquay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Mann, for bringing this bill forward. I think what Senator Swazinski touched on is something that's at the root of this, and it's really important that we say it, which is we devalue education more broadly because women typically do it. And then underneath that system of devaluing, all of the rest of the tiers come in, right? So if we have critical staff, critical support staff, and they tend to be people of color, and they tend to be immigrants, and they tend to be people that we further devalue in society, we pay them less, we pay them less, and we hope that their love for the children that they're caring for overrides the paying into a district for their health insurance. And so this is important because the systems that we have set up for the way that we pay people, that's what shows up in the way that this happens. And so your legislation goes a long way to correct that. And I'm so appreciative of the people who come and talk about this because they're taking time out of their workday that they get paid for to talk about this and to share these really personal stories. And, you know, I appreciate every bill you bring forward in this committee because it always addresses these critical issues. And so we couldn't have schools if we don't have kids at school because no one drove them there. Like, we don't have schools, right? And so it gets to the really critical pieces of the things that are happening in our schools. And I'm really grateful to all the work that you have done to move this forward. And I, too, have a complaint, which is that there's no more room on the bill. So maybe Senator Gustafson and I can work on a clone. But thank you for all your hard work on this.
Anyone else? Well, I have to chime in because, first of all, today is Para Appreciation Day nationally. So my lovely administrator here, his mother is a para out on the East Coast, and she got a lovely basket this morning, which reminded us that today is Para Appreciation Day. I think you've heard from a number of teachers on this panel that see and hear these struggles every single day that we were teachers. I saw it in so many different ways. When we talk about a wage that doesn't pay for anything than insurance, I had an EA, we called him EA, educational assistant, who worked, her husband was disabled. She worked just for insurance. At the end of the day, she didn't have any money left to take home from her paycheck. She had to go out and get a second job to do that. That's not right. When COVID hit, I had an EA. She was a young mother with a daughter with disability. She too, she was living in her mother's basement. And when COVID hit and the thought of no income, no ability to pay for that insurance, can you imagine what that was like? And so it is absolutely important that we do continue to have these conversations and look at valuing and recognizing the fact that paras and education assistants are the people that meet your kid at the bus when they arrive. They're the ones that get them to their classroom. They're the ones that take them to the bathroom. They're the ones that get them to lunch and then back to the classroom again. They're the ones that are sitting next to your student, helping them with their reading and their math and their other skills. These are the people that make our classrooms work. They should have a decent wage. They should have a say in what kind of professional development they get. And if school districts were doing it right, we wouldn't have to legislate it. And I have seen it firsthand time and time again. So when we talk about the legislature mandating things, if it was being done and it was being done in the best way possible, we wouldn't have to bring these things up. So we'll continue this conversation, and Senator Mann, I can't thank you enough for bringing it forward. Very well thought out, very comprehensive, and we appreciate it. Thank you. So with that, Senate file 1318 will be laid over for possible inclusion as amended. Thank you. Next, we have on our docket Senator Gustafson, Senate file 3370. And this is for student teacher stipend establishment and appropriation. Senator Gustafson, when you're ready, and I believe you have an A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do have an A1 amendment.
Would you like to explain that for us?
I would love to, if I could find it. I think I left it at my desk. But two copies. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So basically, the stipend that we'll be discussing in the bill is what we're saying is that money that the teachers or the student teachers would receive would not be used against them when it comes to any other assistance programs that they might be on or qualify for. And beyond that, I would probably turn to our experts at the table to explain more. But that's essentially what it does, is that the stipend that we'll talk about in this bill would not affect them if they're qualifying for other programs.
Would you like somebody to explain, or is that clear enough? Okay, that's okay. All right, you may proceed with your we're going to have a quick vote on that amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Amendment passes, and you may begin on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For those of you who are not teachers, and I know there's a lot of people behind me who are teachers, who have been teachers, and there's also people in front of me the same way. When you become a teacher, you, if you go the traditional route, you're a college student, and then you, spend full-time hours teaching for about 3 months, and then you go back to college and you finish your degree and you graduate and hopefully get a teaching job. If you are non-traditional, you have to leave whatever current job you have. You have to quit that job, take a student teaching job, and then after those 3 months, you either have to try and find a new job again as you finish up your degree, or you try to sub or whatever it is that you can do if you qualify to sub, because you're not a licensed teacher at that point yet. So the problem with that, for two things, if you're the college student, it might not seem like it's that big of a deal that you aren't getting paid for this 3 months of work, and I think the concerns are obvious. If you are a non-traditional student, having to quit a job to do a full-time job that you don't get paid for. The problem with all of it is that it makes it so you can't work any really other job. You take home the work that you do during the day, and you grade papers or you work on your lessons for the next day. You're really not able to do another job unless you do it on the weekends. But the biggest problem is that you are asking people to work full-time hours for no pay. And we all say, well, it's part of the program, but it's not necessarily part of the program. It's full-time work, and you're also having to pay to do that full-time work. And there are not many internships that you could point to nowadays that are for free doing full-time work that are required in order to get the license that you need. So this bill is just saying that we would provide a stipend to all those who are interested in student teaching. And it addresses one of the concerns, is that we are losing teachers. There are not a lot of people interested. There are a lot of people, but not as many, and it's showing up in our schools. Whenever there's an open position available, it's hard to find candidates who want to become teachers. So this is what the bill does. It creates a paid student teaching program, provides student teachers with a stipend during their student teaching period. The bill mandates that student teachers consider as temporary employees receive stipends facilitated by the host schools and reimbursed by the Department of Education. The stipends are dispersed in two installments, one at the beginning and one at the end of student teaching period, which offers financial stability throughout the duration of their training. The benefits of this, it provides stipends. The bill takes away the financial burdens on student teachers, which allows them to focus on their training. The financial support will potentially attract more students to the teaching profession, especially in a time where there is a teacher shortage. The stipend program makes the teaching profession more accessible for students of diverse backgrounds. And there's an urgency to this. The teacher shortage in Minnesota requires immediate action to support and incentivize students pursuing a career in education. This bill addresses this need by providing a financial incentive for student teachers and pays them for the work that they are doing in our classrooms. That is the bill. Madam Chair, we do have some testifiers. I don't know what order you have them in, but I'll let you take it from here.
Thank you so much for that. I have first on my list Laura Mogelson, Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Associate of Colleges of Teacher Education. If you would just reintroduce yourself and then you may begin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Mogelson and I am from the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. Thank you, Senator Gustafson, for your work on this bill, and thank you, members of the committee. As I was leaving my house this morning, one of my kids, who's a senior in high school, asked where I was off to so early, and I said, I'm going to talk to a group of senators about paid student teaching. And he said, student teachers aren't paid? I said, nope. He said, that doesn't make any sense. Isn't that one of the most important jobs? So I said, yes, I agree, and I'm excited to go and talk about it to the senators. Just for some context, and I'll build off of what the senators said, student teachers must complete a minimum of 12 continuous weeks of full-time student teaching. This is a requirement of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board that student teachers do this 12 weeks. And for most student teachers, this is indeed an unpaid experience. Student teachers are indeed paying for credits while they are student teachers, which may seem counterintuitive, so I just want to clarify about that. The credits they're paying for are a part of the degree program that they're enrolled in, so undergraduate or graduate level. In fact, one-third of the over 2,000 student teachers in Minnesota are at the post-baccalaureate or graduate level. So we have a mix of University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, and private colleges that prepare teachers in Minnesota. And of those, we have a mix of graduate and undergraduate. The graduate student teacher might be that career changer. They are often people that have a content degree. Maybe it's Spanish or English or chemistry, or they majored in psychology and want to become a special education teacher, and they're going into the profession to earn their license at that post-baccalaureate level. So historically, unpaid internships used to be quite common, and this has really gone out of practice in the majority of other fields besides education in the United States. So typically, you know, historically, teachers were prepared at the undergraduate level. They may have lived at home with their parents. This has changed, obviously, over the decades, and now we have many people that are paraprofessionals that are going to become teachers, or they are career changers, or they are that undergraduate student, and they're doing student teaching in that final semester, and it is 3 months of unpaid work. Then they're often picking up a second job, adding to the burden and the stress of their experience as a developing teacher. So this support in Senate File 3370 would provide financial stability for student teachers. We do have some grant programs out there right now, which we're very appreciative for, our student teachers are. However, they're competitive and they're not necessarily guaranteed, and sometimes they don't even come until after the student teaching period. So this would really level the playing field, help significantly with the teacher shortage and recruitment. And so with that, we just strongly encourage you to support this bill, and I'm available if you have any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mogelson. Next, we have Matt Shaver, the Policy Director for Ed Allies.
Chair Kunish, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Matt Shaver. I'm an elementary school teacher and the policy director at Ed Allies. We work to leverage state policy to improve outcomes for kids. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate File 3370 as amended. Thank you to Senator Gustafson for being the teacher leader that you are on a bill that will be another piece of the puzzle to ensure all students have access to effective and diverse educators. Student teaching is the critical component of a candidate's teacher prep experience. I did my student teaching experience in Moorhead Public Schools, fifth grade with Ms. Pitts at Ellen Hopkins Elementary. It was a formative experience in my development as an educator. There are only so many times you can read about the importance of building relationships with students, or so many group projects spent practicing lesson planning. You have to see it. What it actually looks like to cultivate and tend to student relationships over time. You have to feel what it's like to have 30 sets of eyes on you as you try and lead instruction. You have to learn how to fail, reflect, make adjustments, and get yourself ready to try again the next day. Nothing can fully prepare you to be a teacher, but nothing prepares you better for what it's actually like to be a teacher than student teaching. But it's an expensive experience in two ways, as we've heard today, for pre-service teachers: the cost of the credits and the opportunity cost of working for those 12 weeks without pay. These barriers to teaching, acutely felt by those taking a non-traditional path, can and should be removed. We support Senate File 3370 because it works toward addressing the latter in a revolutionary way: pay people for their work. And make no mistake, student teaching is work. All student teachers should be paid a professional wage, but in a year where resources are tight and tough choices are required, we would urge leaders to focus on supporting the diverse teacher workforce our students deserve and prioritize additional resources for student teacher stipends on demographically underrepresented teachers. I want to thank Senator Gustafson for leadership on the bill. Thank you to Chair Kunesh for the opportunity to testify this morning. Thank you all for your public service to our state.
Thank you, Mr. Shaver. Next, we have Kalia Kelly Ellis. I believe she is joining us remotely. If you would, are you there? Yes, you are. If you would state your name for the record, and then you may begin.
Sounds good. So I am Kalia Kelly Ellis, and Chair Kunesh, members of the community or committee. My name is Kalia Kelly Ellis, and I'm a senior at Winona State studying special education. And I am the local vice president for Winona State's chapter of Education Minnesota, Aspiring Educators. In addition to this, I am also on the state board for Education Minnesota, Aspiring Educators. I will student teach in the upcoming fall semester, and I will graduate in December 2024. And I'm very excited to continue my teaching journey throughout student teaching and have an opportunity to grow alongside my students. So first, I want to thank Senator Gustafson for her important representation as a teacher in the Senate and working on this bill to pay student teachers. I have classmates who have changed majors, dropped their, taken a leave from their education, or dropped out entirely because of the extreme financial burden during our required student teaching semester. So if you don't come from money, which most of us don't, or if you're unable to work during this time, which most of us can't, we are in a difficult position where we have to choose between gas or food. So some make the difficult decision to take out more expensive loans that they cannot pay off on a starting teacher's salary. Not only do we pay tuition for a semester where we're not taking classes, we also have to serve full-time as a teacher in the classroom. So we lesson plan, attend meetings, support students, and more while cooperating with our cooperating teacher. And this is all while driving 20, 40, or even 60 minutes away to our placement, which is a decision that we have no say in. So, as mentioned before, student teaching is one of the most important pieces of our teacher preparation, and which is why it's required for our programs in order to receive our degrees and licensure. So there is no better way to get this hands-on experience, learn classroom management, and learn how to best support students. We would just like this experience to be more similar to our classmates who are interning and getting on-the-job experience in other sectors, where most of the students I know are paid for their work. So I really do love teaching, absolutely love it, and I want to be there to make my students' lives better and to push them to be the best that I know that they can be. I believe that public education for every kid is one of the best things a government can do. With the current educator shortage, 9 out of 10 schools are not being able to find enough teachers, and I'm really worried about the future of education in Minnesota. Enrollment in programs like mine, where we graduate with a Minnesota teaching license and are likely to stay here, is half of what enrollment was a decade ago. I hope that you all will take real systematic steps in addressing the educator shortage before it gets too late. Bills like this show that Minnesota supports student teachers during their hardest semester of teacher preparation, and it also shows that future educators are supported by the state of Minnesota. And this would do so much to recruit young people like me into this profession, and would also influence students to finish their education degrees. So this automatic, easy-to-use, pay-for-student teachers through districts will recruit many more dedicated young professionals like me to become teachers. So thank you for taking the time to hear me today, and please support student teachers with state investment this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly Ellis. Any other folks who would like to testify on this? Oh, we do have a testifier in the back. Come on up. If you would state your name for the record, and then you may begin.
Yeah, you can do it afterwards.
Yep, just speak right into the microphone.
Thank you, Chair Kunish, and members of the committee for opening your floor. My name is Hamza Ismail. I graduated from Concordia St. Paul last spring, and I currently work at Higher Ground Academy. As a first-year teacher, I'm here to testify in support of 3370. Last year, I began student teaching at my current school, and it was an experience I am extremely grateful for. It taught me far more than the classroom could ever teach, no pun intended. I learned how to motivate students. I learned how to create lesson plans while keeping track of each student's different cultural backgrounds and stations in education. I also learned that I was not being paid for my time. I was quite confused, if I'm being honest, but I understood why. It would require sacrifices, but I believe it could work. I was wrong. I started waking up at 5 a.m. just to get ready and left school at 4 p.m., but as any working person knows, the job follows you home. Exhausted, I would eat, take a nap, and get up to work some more. Some nights, I had to make lesson plans for the following day. Other nights, I had to grade. After a month into student teaching, I was doing both while also teaching all four classes. Now again, this is a blessing. This gave me so much needed experience, but experience doesn't pay the bills. I would be lying if I said it was an easy transition. I had to quit my job halfway through in order to not fall behind. That meant I had to rely on what little money I had saved up from the previous semester for two things, tuition and general necessities. I could not find another job to work because it would hamper my student teaching, which I was paying tuition for. Teaching is harder than most think, especially for us rookies. On the weekends, I hold myself up in my room to grade or was running errands for my family. When May arrived, I emptied my account and my family savings account to pay off my final semester. And on graduation day, while I was being chucked into the air, don't worry, I'm fine, my family was ecstatic. They came here with nothing, penniless, didn't know English, and finally, they had a first-generation college graduate. When we went out to eat, I had $8 left to my name. Student teaching gives college students the experience and responsibilities of teaching, but none of the benefits. Experience pays off in the long run, they say, but the assumption is you'll be able to make it to the finish line. Many student teachers, especially people of color, simply cannot afford student teaching. Paying student teachers will help pave the way for future educators, which in turn will help better our communities. Remember, we have a teacher shortage for a reason. Thank you so much for allowing me to share my testimony. Take care.
Thank you so much for that testimony. We appreciate that. Anybody else care to testify? All right, we will go to members. Any comments or questions? Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering to the author how you came up with the number that is out there. Are you hoping, were you looking at the, like, how many students are out there typically and coming? Had a specific number that you're hoping to give them, and that's how you came to this number? Or is this something you're just hoping to get and it'll be divided evenly amongst the students?
Senator Gustafson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Rarick. The number was based on numbers that we expected would be used, but you know, it's really hard to be able to say exactly what the number would end up being. So, yeah, great question. But it's based on what we think we know and the amount that it'll be used for.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So depending on what we have available too, is this number flexible and it just would be evenly divided amongst all students? Is that kind of the intention of whatever goes in, it would be evenly divided? Or is it more you're looking at a specific number that you would like the stipend to be and it would be a first come first serve basis? Do you know? Because I don't see that it specifies either of those things in the bill.
Senator Gustafson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Rarick, if it's okay, if I could lean on maybe Mr. Arneson or Ms. Hoffer to sort of talk about the exact stipend and how it's distributed. They're probably going to be able to explain it a little bit better than I am, if that's okay with you, Senator Rarick.
Ms. Hoffer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Rarick for the question. To address your earlier question, I believe the figure would provide about $15 per hour to the approximately 2,500 student teachers per year. And then as for how it would be distributed, on page one of the bill under subdivision two, it states that by March 30th of each year, Pelsby would provide the commissioner of the Department of Education the projected number of student teachers for the following year. Then on page two, the commissioner would establish a stipend amount based on that projected number of student teachers and the funds available for the program. And then from there, the commissioner would establish the process for which the host schools would apply for reimbursement for the stipends.
Yep, response.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So ultimately, what that's describing then is they would be dividing out what's available kind of on an even basis so that each student would be getting approximately the same based on the funding available.
Ms. Hofer.
Madam Chair, Senator Rarick, that's correct. There would be an established stipend amount per teacher, so that would go out then evenly to those. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yep.
One more. Ms. Snyder, did you want to make a comment on that?
Madam Chair, if I may, Caitlin Snyder, Education Minnesota. As Ms. Kelly Ellis referenced, our aspiring educators, so about 3,000 people currently pursuing the art of teaching, have been very fantastically supportive of this bill and a number of others to support student teachers. The priorities that the aspiring educators have sort of outlined are not having an application that the student teachers need to have. So if you look, there's a similar program through the Office of Higher Education. And if you look at who gets those student teacher stipends, it's really located at about four or five of our teacher prep institutions. It's very much people don't know to apply for it, so it's only at certain places. So we're hoping to remove that barrier of the application and have this connection to the district. As the committee does their work within the budget target, the aspiring educators have prioritize not having that application and having perhaps a regional model to bring forward some results for next year when we're establishing the larger budget. And the total stipend amount is not in the bill, but we've been operating from the assumption that it would be the same as the higher education student teacher stipend, which is set at $7,500 a student teacher.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead, Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm also wondering, as I see this as set up, that the host school would be paying the stipend, and this would be a reimbursement to the host school. Is there a reason we're doing it that way rather than the stipend going directly to the student? Because I'm guessing that the host school has never had any financial relationship with the student teachers, and now this would be putting that on them. If this is a stipend, why wouldn't it be kind of considered like a scholarship that would be run through the higher ed system rather than the whole school district paying it?
Senator Gustafson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rarick. I think, you know, these are reasonable questions, and I think, like, you know, there are reasons why we could do it. The idea there is that you sort of become a temporary employee of that school, and you have to, you know, you get insured through your college. The college sets up your training for you. So I think, you know, the stipend works through that way. If there's other ways to do it, obviously open to that, but it makes it sort of a streamlined process. Again, Senator Kunesh, if you're okay with
it. Go ahead. Looks,
Ms. Hoffer or Mr. Arneson would like to explain a little bit more, but the stipend works that way, as I think is a level of just streamlining what we're already doing.
Mr. Arneson?
Madam Chair, members, I might just also say that in general, the stipend is going to be taxable federally and at the state level as income to the student. And in that sense, it might make some practical sense to run it through the district's existing payroll systems, you know, for withholdings and other associated payroll and state and federal tax calculations.
Thank you. Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I mean, I guess I'll follow up more offline on some of those questions, see if what might make the most sense. My other question then is, seeing with what was just stated as well and seeing the amendment that's in front of or that was adopted, is this being laid over here, or does this now need to go to some of these other committee areas to evaluate, I guess, to ask the question, can we really say that this can't be considered as income for consideration in these other funds? That's something I don't know, and mm-hmm. just wondering if some of these other committee areas would want to take a look at that piece that was just added.
It is our intention to lay it over, but if we reach out to other committees that say they want to hear it, then we would be open to expanding it to those conversations. Yep. And Ms. Snyder.
Madam Chair, Caitlin Snyder, Education Minnesota, thank you for your indulgence. I just wanted to come up here because Senator Rarick's question is a good question. There are various models of how to do this. You can do it through the teacher prep system. You could do it individually to the student. Why the aspiring educators are so excited about Senator Gustafson's bill is that post-COVID, it has been really hard to find a school that wants to take on a student teacher. It's really hard to find a teacher that wants to take on a student teacher. So we're hoping that by having this intersection with the district that we'll not only pay people that are in the program, but that will create better relationships between districts and the higher ed institutions to create more cooperating teachers and student teacher placements.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Senator Swedzinski.
Ms. Snyder, thank you, Madam President, or Madam Chair. Ms. Snyder, what do you mean? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but we're finding it harder to find school districts to take on student teachers post-COVID. I'm just wondering what would make, again, I'm not trying to come across as,
absolutely.
But what? Why would we have that dilemma right now?
Ms. Snyder.
Madam Chair and Chair Swedzinski, you might be aware that a lot of teachers are very burnt out right now. And for some, taking on a student teacher is a great way of expanding the profession, but for others, it's another responsibility on their plate. There's no, most of the time, there's no compensation for the cooperating teacher who is mentoring that teacher, so for some people, it feels like another lift on their plate. Also, during COVID, of course, people were limiting their interactions as much as possible. There was online student teaching during the height of COVID. But as we reopened our schools and reopened our doors, some people had concerns about bringing folks into the classroom in that way. And once that relationship is broken between, MSUM and the Moorhead Public Schools, just an example, I think their relationship is great. Once that relationship has sort of deteriorated, it's hard to build it back up. I think Ms. Kelly Ellis made a reference to this, but part of what's happening with our student teachers is because it's harder to find places that will take student teachers, they're having to drive further. They're having to drive perhaps 45 minutes one way each day that they're in the classroom. So we're hoping that this helps incentivize more places to have student teachers in the first place.
Follow up?
Yeah, and this question might be more for Ms. Mogelson. You had said during your testimony, most student teachers are not paid. Do we know of examples where student teachers are being paid?
Ms. Mogelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Swedzinski, there are programs where student teachers are paid, and those are typically referred to as residency programs, where a district has funding. We do have a residency stream of funding now in Minnesota. There's also federal funds that have come into the state to pay for residency programs, and this is where student teachers are doing year-long student teaching placements. Typically, they're recruited from the ESP or para pool within the district, and then they become a student teacher resident, and they get paid a full salary and benefits. But those are, it's a small number in the larger context.
Senator Swedzinski?
Yeah, I never had a student teacher, but I do know towards the tail end of my career, my district started offering $100 stipend for a student, for the mentor teachers to take on a student teacher. And we in our department just thought, oh my God, $100 after taxes, you'd start to take on the responsibilities of having a student teacher, because it is a lot of work. The young student from, was she from Winona, the student teacher? Both student teachers' testimonies, but were very powerful, hers in particular, and her experience that she's going through. The hardest I ever worked in my life, besides Sammy's Pizza in Superior, Wisconsin, was student teaching. And to not ever get paid for that experience, the irony of that never failed to escape me. And so I just want to thank you, Senator Gustafson, for bringing this bill forward. It's a long time coming. Does anybody in the audience know, perhaps, are principals, internships, and I wish we didn't call it student teaching. I don't know why we don't call it student intern or intern teaching. It almost demeans the student teaching sounds something. It's not as admirable of a call, of a title, as it deserves. And I'm just wondering, if I wanted to be a principal and I take on an internship, am I paid at that level? That's more of a, I'm just looking, it's a rhetorical question, but if somebody has the answer, I'm just wondering if they have to be unpaid as well.
Senator Gustafson, I'll go first to you, and then Senator Cruen.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I feel all these people who want to chime in right now, so I just was going to help, you know, as you and I are both classroom teachers, my immediate thought was, let's make sure everyone's heard. I think my testifier has something to answer to that, and then, of course, Madam Chair, whatever you think is best after that.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, as Senator Swedzinski, no, that internship for a principal licensure is typically not paid, to my knowledge. Madam Chair, may I address Senator Rarick's earlier question quickly about the... It relates to the amendment, too?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eric, in higher education institutions at both the graduate and undergraduate level, enrolled students often braid together lots of different types of funding and can be awarded money up to what's called the cost of attendance. And so that's for the tuition, room, and board. You know, you've typically heard of that especially at the undergraduate level. The advantage of this support and funding coming in not directly via the institution of higher education is that it wouldn't negatively impact other aid that they're receiving, because sometimes what happens is if a student gets an award, it might kick out another award that they've received or another scholarship and reduce the aid that they're getting overall. And so what this would do is prevent that impact, if that's helpful to your question.
Thank you, Ms. Mogelson. That makes a lot of sense. Senator Cruen, or Farnsworth, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take that as a compliment that you think I'm smarter than I actually am. So first I wanted to reference Senator Swedzinski's question about principals. So principals, I think they have to do either 400 or 500 hours. So they don't have to do this 16-week block where they have to do it full time. And so there's more flexibility. Most principals are, you know, were previously teachers, and so they're able to work with their school districts and say, hey, can I get my hours in during my prep time or, you know, during this different time? So they don't have to give up salary in order to do it. Although most of them have probably already done their student teaching. So I sort of wanted to add a little bit to the answer on that's where most principals come from. And then I just wanted to comment about this. This is another one that I'm sympathetic to. I did my student teaching in 2000 at Moundsview High School, and I couldn't believe that I had to pay $500 a credit to go and work for free, and I had a friend who was an actuary, and it turns out that he got a paid internship during our senior year of college, and his internship actually paid me more than I made my first year of teaching, which kind of amazed me. So this is definitely something that I'm open to. I just want to maybe drop one further idea on this. Another thing that Senator Swedzinski said was student teaching was the hardest thing that he's ever done. And I would modify that. The hardest thing that I ever did was my first year of full teaching on my own, because you don't have those teachers to rely on. I felt woefully unprepared to be a teacher my first year. My recommendation would be it shouldn't be one 16-week period. We should do a full year of student teaching. And, you know, maybe half year with one teacher and then a half year with another teacher, so you learn different methods. And I can say without reservation that I learned more about being a teacher from teaching than I did in a lot, you know, all of the educational preparation classes. And so I think this is a good idea. This is a good discussion to have, but I think we need to maybe move it a little further and say we probably need to do a little bit more student teaching. But, you know, then that leads to the question, okay, if it's free, how do you expect somebody to work for free for a year? So I'm open to it. I just kind of wanted to add that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farnsworth. Anybody else? I think those of us that are teachers here understand the incredible impact that this bill would have. When I went through my student teaching experience, I was in my mid-30s. I had three kids. I was a single mom by then, going to weekend college and doing family daycare to support myself. And I put as much money away as I could, knowing that I wouldn't be paid for those 4 months. And had great experience, learned a lot, had a promise of a job once I graduated. I graduated in December of that year. So starting in January, I could have started teaching with Minneapolis Public Schools, but the government went on shutdown. So I couldn't apply for my license, and that's back in the day when you had to mail things in, and then they send it back, and you mail it back in. Long story short, I ran out of money for my family. I was broke, basically broke, and ended up on public assistance for about a year and a half until I could finally sort of dig myself out. If we had a paid student teaching experience, I think that would have been a very different outcome for me, and it might even have prevented me from having to rely on the safety net of our state. And I remember my dad, he was a really great guy when it came to like human rights and things like that. And I remember there was a conversation where people were talking about, oh, those welfare moms or those people that just, he said, those services, those dollars are there to help us. Those are the safety nets for our communities. And I was really appreciative that I had that safety net. If I hadn't had the safety net of the state, I would have lost my house, couldn't feed my kids, get them to the doctors. And so if this is one way, I mean, if we invest this way, we might be saving money on the other end as well. So I think we all have like horror stories of student teaching and finances. But I think this is really a valuable piece of legislation that I would like to continue to investigate. And I really appreciate you bringing it forward. So with that, any final words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say I really appreciated the conversation, and I agree with Senator Farnsworth that, you know, this is really tough. I didn't know that you went through Moundsview, which is, again, my kid's school. I think that it is, you know, we put a lot of money and investments into pathways for other careers last session. This is another version of that. It is saying that we want more teachers, and we want to respect them for what they do. The only drawback I would say for what Senator Farnsworth was talking about was, and sort of what Senator Swadzinski was talking about too, and kind of ironic that the stipend that schools would be willing to pay went to the teacher, not the student teacher. So again, but is that you? Then you'd have to find a teacher who would want to mentor for an entire year, and that might be even, you know, more difficult to find, because it is. I mean, when I left Centennial, I had 41 kids in my classroom, only 36 desks, by the way. And so it was really difficult. If someone would have said, can you take on a student teacher, there's just absolutely no way I would have been able to do it. So, yeah, I mean, it's all, the conversation continues, but
yep.
Yeah, thank you very much for hearing and considering our bill.
Thank you, and thanks for this really robust conversation. So with that, Senator Gustafson, Senate File 3370 will be laid over for possible inclusion as amended. Next up is me. Senator Gustafson, if you'd come take over, that'd be lovely.
Senator Kunesh, whenever you're ready, welcome to your committee. We're going to be laying over SF-5204 for possible inclusion in a future omnibus, and I understand A2 amendment is ready if you would like to move that and then explain it.
Yep, I so move the A2 amendment. It basically just, it's a delete all and updates all the information in the bill.
All right, members, any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Kunesh, to your bill.
Thank you, Senator Gustafson. This bill is here to create a 24-member teacher and paraprofessional compensation working group. It's comprised of 13 teachers with experience in various grades, subject areas, statewide regions, six paraprofessionals with experience in various grades and statewide regions, two superintendents, one community education director, two school finance directors, and those persons need to be appointed by MDE by November 1st of 2024. The reason for this working group is to advise the legislature on strategies and recommendations to provide competitive compensation to teachers and paraprofessionals in Minnesota schools. This working group must propose draft legislation to committees with jurisdiction over education and policy. This bill will help the legislature determine how to address teacher and paraprofessional compensation through future legislation, and we're hoping that it will bring in many teachers and paraprofessionals to provide insight into how they are personally compensated and how to make the system of compensation better and more equitable. And that is my bill.
All right. Thank you, Senator Kunesh. Members, any questions? All right. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Rarick.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was getting things organized here. Just one quick question. Is it your intent that any recommendations that come out of this group be recommendations that are a majority vote or a consensus of all? Because I see the membership is 19 members that would be teachers and only 5 that would be administrative. So I'm just kind of wondering what the thought process would be, how the recommendations would come out of this commission.
Sure. Madam Chair, and I apologize. I know you have some testifiers, so we skipped over that,
right.
But
we
that's okay.
That. Yes, the recommendations, I would hope, are a consensus of the group. If there are some suggestions that at the end of the day were not included in there, I think it would be important to understand what they are and why they were not included, if that came up in the conversation. So I think there's opportunity to listen to everybody. And testifiers, yes.
Yeah, Senator Rarick, any follow-up? No. All right, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name. And you may proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Justin Killian. Thank you, Senator Kunesh. Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to speak today in favor of Senate File 5204 on behalf of the 86,000 educator members of Education Minnesota. We thank the senator for authoring this bold step toward finally moving the needle on equitable compensation for Minnesota's educators. It's a long overdue conversation. I remember at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic when we all went into lockdown and we were all in our houses and we couldn't leave our houses, and parents for the first time were doing their work, and then they were also serving as teachers, right? They were having to help with algebra and they were having to help with geometry, and they were doing this advanced reading and looking at history texts that they hadn't thought about in years. And at that time, about 77% of U.S. citizens believed that teachers should be paid more, and about 69% of Americans believe that being a teacher is harder than their own job. At Education Minnesota, we even collected anecdotal evidence of people saying teachers should be paid six figures minimum because this work is hard and I am only dealing with my own child, not 30 running around the same room. Unfortunately, that enthusiasm faded a bit when we all went back to our normal lives, but still an overwhelming majority of about 56% of Americans believe we need better compensation for teachers, and that crosses both party lines. It's both Republicans and Democrats think educator compensation is too low. But the reality is that we always talk about it and we don't do anything about it. And so this bill is the first step of moving us in a direction of moving our school systems and the way we staff schools and compensate teachers away from old racist and extremely sexist pay models that have not evolved to meet the current realities of the profession. I'd like to thank Senator May Quaid in an earlier testimony for bringing up how there is a pay gap for women and there is a pay gap for BIPOC communities when we start breaking this down. But how bad is the educator pay gap? The Economic Policy Institute talks about it as the teacher pay penalty, and what we mean by that is we compare the amount of training it takes to become a teacher to like professions that require the same amount of training. Currently, in 2022, teachers are making 26.4% less money than people in comparable professions that required the same amount of training. To give you some comparison, in 1996, that pay gap was only 6.1%. So we have not kept up and we have not closed that gap in any capacity. But this isn't just about the teachers. This is also about our paraprofessionals, the people that are doing food service and driving buses. Between 2014 and 2019, the median weekly wage, and I'm doing this in 2020 dollars, not 2014 dollars, was about $331 for food service workers, $493 for school bus drivers, and $507 for the teaching assistants. In contrast, the median United States worker in all professions earns about $790 per week. But when we talk about compensation, we have to remember just a few other things. Compensation is not just about how much money I'm taking home. Compensation is an entire package of resources. And our educators have some of the highest divorce rates. There is an unprecedented level of mental health issues among our educators. We're seeing alarming rates of suicide. And we know that educators enter the profession for altruistic reasons and not for high salaries, but that doesn't mean that we should be paying them wages that doesn't allow them to support their families. So they need affordable, comprehensive insurance. They need a reliable pension that values the service they've given to the state of Minnesota, and they need an equitable family-supporting wage. And when we talk about compensation, there are just a few other things to remember. The first is unpaid labor. Educators, both teachers and paraprofessionals, continue to perform tremendous amounts of unpaid labor that we don't see in other professions. In the 2023 State of the American Teacher Survey, which is a nationally representative survey, we found that on average, one out of every four teachers worked each week, one out of every 4 hours a teacher works each week was uncompensated. And so about an average of 15 hours a week teachers are doing without pay. The second is the out-of-pocket cost that no one talks about. Teachers continue to purchase supplies for their students in classrooms that we would not ask of other professionals. We don't ask the senators on this panel to buy the supplies for your offices, right? But that's not the case for our teachers. The U.S. Department of Education has showed us that 94% of teachers reach into their own pockets to purchase the basic necessities they need for their classrooms. And on average, they spend about $500 to $750 annually on these expenses. And when we
Dr. Killian, I just want to say, if you could wrap it up a little bit, we do have another bill we need to get to.
I apologize. At schools with a high percentage of eligible for free and reduced lunch, that's as high as 75%. So we ask that this bill be passed. We know that 63% of Minnesotans believe that educators deserve more, and when we start looking at the overall cost, this would not be that tremendous of a lift for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that testimony. I could listen all day to how teachers are not probably paid what they should be, or I know if they're not, but yeah, we do want to get to our discussion. So members, any questions or comments? Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Kunesh, for this important topic of valuing our teachers and making sure that they are compensated for their incredible sacrifice and energy that they pour into their classroom, into their students every day. But my question is to the testifier. I was intrigued with your assertions that the pay models are sexist and racist. Could you please elaborate for me? Because I've never been part of the negotiations. Could you help elaborate how the teachers' unions are negotiating these sexist and racist pay models?
Dr. Killian.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Lucero, for your question. I think to answer your question, it's two part. The first is like, why are they sexist and racist? And then the second part of your question, if I understand it, is what is Education Minnesota and other unions doing about that? So if we look at the history of teaching and the profession, it's been primarily a profession that we have relied on a predominantly female workforce. And so when we started setting up and professionalizing teaching, and this is, I'm talking 50 years in the past, we started setting up pay scales, there was a general kind of cultural assumption that, oh, women have husbands and this is just something that they're doing on the side, or it's like an additional income for families. And so for many, we can point to that the pay scales that were originally set up in those sexist models. Also, we can look at the same when we talk about schools that serve and districts that serve primarily students of color, kind of the same structural issues came into play. And there's been no kind of systematic effort ever to go back and investigate how, oops, we probably didn't start at the best place possible, and now we need to correct for past injustices. As far as, you know, what Education Minnesota and unions are negotiating, we constantly bring this up at the table. We constantly show data to show that, you know, female educators will typically sometimes, because if they have families and they take time off, right, they will put a pause in their career, and this will affect how they land on the salary schedule when they return back to their to the classroom, and so that there need to be provisions within the contract that account for the time that they're away from the classroom, but it shouldn't penalize them when they come back, and they shouldn't start at a lower rate because they took that time off to have a family or to take care of a loved one. So those are just some of the examples. So we are bringing those conversations to the table and trying to get districts to realize the historical inequities that have taken place and that need to be corrected.
Senator Lucero, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, nothing I heard there explained these allegations of racism and sexism. Now, there are certainly differences within different professions, but I think it's mental laziness. As I've heard multiple times this morning in different bills, to chalk up observations and differences in professions to racism and sexism. And so I just wanted to make sure it's on the record, Madam Chair, that while these allegations continue to be made, I think it's mental laziness. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator McQuaid.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Kunesh, for bringing this forward. My mom's favorite story to tell about me is the first fight we ever got into, and it was when I was in first grade, and I was like, teachers make the most money. And she said, no, they don't. I said, yes, they do, because who could make more money than the people who taught people how to read? And I was like adamant that teachers made the most money. And I stand by that sentiment, but I know now that I'm wrong. But I shouldn't have been, right? Like, first grade me understood fundamentally that the people who educate all of the people in our state and in our country should be making enough money to sustain themselves in their job. And really, we value this so much, and yet we put so little into the people who are doing it. So I appreciate you bringing this forward, and I appreciate you, Doctor, for raising the ways in which we set up the pay structure. And so I think taking a step back and not tinkering on the edges, but like fundamentally looking at how can we actually set up pay compensation and the type of labor conditions that are appropriate for the people who are literally teaching our children not only how to read, not only how to add, but also how to like have conversations with their friends and share and, you know, tie their shoes and open their apples. So, I mean, these are really fundamental skills that children all need, and they should be compensated for it. So I'm really appreciative of your bill and actually taking this step back because it's important that we do it.
Thank you. Members, anyone else? Questions, comments? Senator, did I miss anybody? Sorry, I'm just looking for hands. All right, Senator Kunesh, any final thoughts?
No, thank you for listening to this bill. And Senator Lucero, while you might not agree with the information that is shared here, as chair of this committee, I would ask that you not use or make negative comments to the people that come and testify here today. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Senator Kunesh. With that, Senate File 5204 is laid over as amended for possible inclusion in future omnibus.
Senator Dornick, thank you for your patience. I'm sure you had an earful here today while you were waiting. Appreciate that. We have Senator Dornick's Senate File 4219, and we are expecting to hold this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. When you are ready, you may introduce your bill, and then we'll listen to your testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is Senate File 4219. It's a special education teacher pipeline grant use modification. So last year in 2023, the legislature established a special education teacher pipeline program. This program provides grants to districts, charter schools, and cooperative partnerships with teacher preparation programs to help unlicensed staff or tier one or two teachers get their tier three or four special education license. Senate File 4219, while still prioritizing grant funding for unlicensed staff or tier one or two teachers, modifies the program to allow grants be used for teachers with tier three or tier four license in another field to add a field license in special education. Expanding this program will allow tier three or four teachers working with a provisional license in special education or teacher licensed in another area who want to obtain a special education license to have access to resources to become properly licensed. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce my testifier, Dan Armagost, Executive Director of Southern Minnesota Education Consortium. And also, I just wanted to mention that Dan has been working hard on this bill, and last year was funded, and so thank you for that. And he came up with the idea, and now we're just gonna modify it a little bit. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Armagost, and thank you for being patient as well. You probably drove a little bit on the way here. Maybe you hit some weather, I don't know. But go ahead and tell us what you've got.
All right, I'm Dan Armagost, Executive Director for the Southern Minnesota Education Consortium, SMEC. I've been a Director of Special Education for over 20 years, and this will be my fifth time testifying on behalf of the Special Education Pipeline Bill. I do so on behalf of MSBA, MREA, AMSD, MESA, SEE, and the MACE organizations who also support the proposed changes to this bill. I want to start by saying thank you. Thank you for passing the original Special Education Pipeline Bill. This legislation has helped my cooperative greatly, and I would say districts across the state. It has helped address OSUP's concerns with the state's Tier 1 licensure and has effectively put more special education teachers into the classroom. Our cooperative applied for the Special Education Pipeline Grant with the members of Region 10. As a region, we are made up of 57 districts. Together, we have partnered with 13 different colleges and are currently sending back 22 Tier 1 teachers on our first phase of the Special Education Pipeline Grant, with with another application process starting in a couple months. This has been a tremendous success, and I am extremely grateful. That being said, there is still a shortage in special education in the special education workforce. I have had special education positions open for years without receiving even one licensed candidate. I am still sitting in on general education teacher interviews so that I can recruit the candidates that are not selected for the position. I do this out of necessity. There's simply not enough special education teachers to fill the open positions. As a result, I have some amazing tier 3 and 4 teachers that are currently on out-of-field placements. One of these amazing teachers is working in a level 3 autism program. This is a tough position to fill, and she loves it. She loves the students and the challenges that come with the position. She would tell you that she was meant for the position. Her co-teachers and mentor will tell you that she's a quick learner and that she is a perfect fit. Being a tier 3 teacher on an out-of-field placement, she already knows teacher pedagogy and methodology, so she adapted easily to the position. She has been in the position for 2 years now and will love to stay, but is limited on how long she can be on an out-of-field licensure. When I talk to her about pursuing special education licensure, she states that she wants to, but she had just finished one degree and is not financially able to pursue another. This is the most common response I get for why my tier 3 and 4 teachers are not pursuing special education licensure. We want to address the tier 1 issue, and that should have priority as currently stated in the bill, but I want to address the overall workforce shortage around special education, and this updated language will do that. It will also continue to help districts get fully licensed teachers into the classroom. We are currently on the correct path with the Grow Your Own and the special education pipeline bills. This amended language will help us stay on that path and open the doors for additional teachers. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Anyone with any questions or comments? Sounds like you did an excellent job.
Can I also make a comment, too?
I would love to hear it.
National Paraprofessional Appreciation Day, awesome.
Yep.
I would like to make a point that one of our major groups going back on the pipeline bill are our paraprofessionals. It gives them a path to further their career and what hopefully what some of them are looking for. When we originally at SMEC started this before the pipeline bill and that, we were sending our paraprofessionals back to become teachers. Then our teachers go back to take on leadership roles. When I was sitting here listening to the testimony, I was trying to count back to the number of paraprofessionals that are currently our teachers and administrators. My current special ed coordinator started as a paraprofessional. She went back from her paraprofessional position, got her special ed teaching license position, moved to a department lead, and now is a coordinator. My current due process coordinator, she started as a paraprofessional, went back, got her special ed license, got a specialist license in deaf of hard of hearing, and now she's our case facilitator. We have another one that went back as our paraprofessional, got her special ed license, became a specialist, and now she's our department lead. There's definitely a path, and I think this bill creates that path for our paraprofessionals also. Thank you.
That is such a really great story. I think of all the years that I was teaching, and we'd have paras or EAs, and I'd say to them, you would make such an excellent teacher. Like, you're doing a lot of that work already. Why don't you, you know, it's an uptick in pay, not the greatest, but why don't you do it? And the fact that there wasn't money, time, all of those sort of things really, I think, had impacts on some of our paras who would have made excellent, excellent teachers, and that's a prime example, so thank you. Senator Gustafson, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Dornick. Just really quick, and don't be offended if there weren't a ton of questions. It's what happens when you go at the end. I think just everyone's tired, and so. But I wanted to appreciate you for coming all this way, and really just this committee today, I think, has been really great because we're all coming to the table with different ways to address the workforce issue that we have, and everyone's like, sort of had a different approach or an idea. But I agree with you, our special ed teachers just do not get enough support, and finding ways to make it easier to find people who would be really good at being special ed teachers to get that position. I just really appreciate you for coming. So thank you so much.
Anyone else? Well, thank you so much, Senator Dornick, for bringing this forward. And thank you, Mr. Armisen, for, Armagost, for bringing this forward to us. And with that, we will be laying this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So with that, members, I think we are done. Once again, if you know paras, if there are things that you can do to thank a para today or every day, any day, all day long, please do that. And with that, we are adjourned.